You Just Can't Trust Tom Ripley. The character was created by novelist Patricia Highsmith and made indelible by Matt Damon in the film The Talented Mr. Ripley. He's back again for a new generation, this time played by Andrew Scott. And unsurprisingly, now he's on Netflix in a series called Simply Ripley.
Tom once again worms his way into the life of one Dickie Greenleaf, who will realize too late that becoming the focus of Tom's attention is going to seriously complicate his life of luxury in Italy. I'm Glenn Weldon.
And I'm Linda Holmes. And today we're talking about Ripley on Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR. Joining me and Glenn today is our co-host, Aisha Harris. Hey, Aisha.
Hello, Linda.
I love it when three of us are together. The character Tom Ripley was created by Patricia Highsmith in the 1955 novel, The Talented Mr. Ripley. She went on to write several more novels about him. The last was published in 1991. While Highsmith wrote several stories about Tom, the new Netflix series tells the same tale as the 1999 movie, The Talented Mr. Ripley. Tom, a con artist played here by Andrew Scott, is sent by a rich shipping magnate to persuade his son, the rich playboy Dickie Greenleaf, to come home from Italy. Dickie is played by Johnny Flynn. Dickie's girlfriend, Marge, played by Dakota Fanning, is suspicious of Tom, and quite rightly so.
Are you hard to find, Tom?
Well, I just moved, so yes, I guess so.
Tom ingratiates himself into Dickie's life and becomes increasingly fascinated by this rich young man and his posh existence in Italy. The 8-episode series, which is filmed in black and white, was written and directed by Steven Zaillian, who made the HBO series The Night Of and is a longtime Hollywood screenwriter who won an Oscar for Schindler's List. It's streaming on Netflix starting today. Glenn, I'm going to start with you. I think that you, like I, happen to be a fan of the Matt Damon movie.
Sure.
I don't know how you came into this, but I came into it with some skepticism. How did you end up feeling about it?
I want more. I want it now. What are there, 5 novels?
Yeah.
5 seasons in a movie. Let's get this done. I mean, yes, there was trepidation, of course, because with any remake, any new adaptation, the question of why always comes up. This is such a specific vision of the story that it justifies its existence completely. And not for nothing, because we are talking about Netflix, justifies its length.
Yeah.
I'll admit, and I shared this with you guys, it took me a second to get into the rhythm of it because it starts out pretty unhurried, I think. Mm-hmm. It's completely justified. There are set pieces in this thing that go on for a very long, 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 long time, but they are doing all kinds of good work, mm-hmm. characterizing work, stake-raising work.
Yeah.
So, yeah, get on it. Put this man to work. More Ripley right now.
Yeah. How about you, Aisha?
Yeah, this is right up my alley. Mm-hmm. In a time where so many shows and movies are now sort of like made in a way that evoke a 2-screen experience.
Sure.
You could be watching anything else or reading anything else while it's on the background. This is not one of those shows. You have to pay attention to it. It demands your attention because there are all these little details. And I almost want to like go back and rewatch some scenes because you might miss them if you're not paying close attention.
Mm-hmm.
I love that. I want more of these shows and movies that like demand my attention. And not just because mm-hmm. a lot of it is in Italian. So there's a lot of subtitles as well, but also because you might miss the cat who is a star of this of a couple of episodes.
Mm-hmm.
There's a cat who lives in the sort of the foyer of one of the apartments he's renting, and the cat sees all.
Mm-hmm.
That cat is doing as much work as the dog in Anatomy of a Fall is
mm-hmm.
doing. So I'm here for all these animal things. I'm also here for Andrew Scott just being really, really fascinating and taking a new spin on this Thomas Ripley character.
Yeah, I loved this.
Yeah.
I loved it immediately. And I totally get what Glenn is saying about it starts off kind of deliberative. But to me, Andrew Scott is so transfixing that I never had any trouble being drawn into it because he is so fascinating to watch, I think. And he has such a specific vision of this character.
Where are you living?
I'm just traveling.
Where?
Around Italy.
Where?
Around.
And if you do know Ripley mostly from the movie, this is a much more kind of con artist from the outset kind of vision of Tom.
Mm-hmm.
The Matt Damon Tom is a more needy kind of, you get the feeling that he desperately wants to be liked. And that sort of is the beginning of how he gets into this. And Dickie and Marge, who were played in the movie by Gwyneth Paltrow and Jude Law, are so beautiful that he's just kind of entranced by them. And I think that it makes for maybe a more menacing, differently stylish way of looking at this. Because the first thing, obviously, the first thing I noticed about this when I watched it, I didn't know it was in black and white until I watched the screeners. And it was such a smart move to me because these people are very aware that there exists a very beloved movie in addition to a novel.
Uh-huh.
And because the movie has that really bright, sunny, Italian, to me, mid-century Cary Grant movie kind of to it, going to this very stark noir look in black and white is such a good way to say from the very beginning, this is a totally different thing. I love the way that they play with light and with shapes. And there are so many just, I think, admirable shots. Mm-hmm. Also, the director of photography here is Robert Elswit, who was the cinematographer on There Will Be Blood and Good Night and Good Luck and Boogie Nights. And to me, most interestingly, Michael Clayton.
Mm. Yeah,
which is also this really kind of dark, tense.
Uh-huh.
Oh, I liked this. I liked this so much.
Right. What it's doing is it's leaning into the Highsmith of it all in a way that the movie didn't really. I mean, the movie is great. The movie's a thriller, a straight-ahead thriller. It is also a sublimated romance. Mm-hmm. It has a much stronger queer subtext to the movie than the show does.
Mm-hmm.
And it goes out of its way to make Tom likable, right? To make excuses for Tom. He starts out, as you say, he starts out as a sweet kid, not a con man. He gets drawn in because there's mistaken identity. He borrows a Princeton jacket, yada, yada, yada. The murder of Dickie in the movie is a crime of passion. It's not this cold act of self-protection.
Mm-hmm.
It even completely creates a gay lover for Tom to have that ends tragically because it wants to underscore that while he may get away with X, Y, and Z, he'll be miserable and tortured and alone for the rest of his life because the universe is a moral one. That may be, you know, satisfying, very pulpy filmmaking. It ain't Highsmith, brother. I'll tell you that much.
This series
is a specifically noir thriller. It is colder. The world is a colder place, more threatening. It's an amoral place. Tom is more calculating. And the choice to shoot in black and white, as you mentioned, Linda, means we can't get dazzled by the postcard gorgeousness of Italy. And Elswit is always shooting scenes through bars, through gates, through banisters, through railings.
Mm-hmm.
Ceilings are always visible. Even in a Venice mansion with like 20-foot high ceilings, you still see the ceilings in every shot. So it's claustrophobic. It's foreboding. And of course, you know, we see this architecture in black and white. We're thinking of Italian cinema. We're thinking of La Dolce Vita, which takes place pretty much in the same time.
Sure.
So as you say, it's referencing so many things, but it's carving out its own identity.
Yeah. And I think also what I love about this is the Hitchcockian way some of these murders take place.
Absolutely. It is so Hitchcock to me.
Which makes sense because, you know, Hitchcock did adapt Strangers on a Train, one of Highsmith's other novels. So like they're simpatico in that way. And we've already kind of touched on this, but this is a very deliberate and at times laborious, but not in a bad way, type of show. And so one murder takes like, you know, 12 minutes, including the cleanup time of just like kind of not quite in real time, but you're watching him figure out, okay, what do I do with his body? And then cut to him waiting until it's late enough for him to actually dispose of the body. And then that takes like another the rest of the episode, basically. When we're spending so much time alone with Tom, we really get a sense of just how methodical this all is and how this is not someone who is driven by passion in a way. He's driven by just like his need to get one over on people and then get away with it. There's like moments of humor in this as well. It's dark, but it's also kind of funny.
Like how much better he gets at climbing stairs over the course of this series. Like he can't do it in the beginning, but by the end he is running up and down stairs all the time. Smart, funny.
They're much more interested in, I think, the logistics of being Tom Ripley.
Yes.
Both the con artist parts of it.
Yeah,
there are a couple of wonderful shots where he's checking into a hotel and he's signing the registry book and the person in the hotel is writing down his name to check. And they shoot the two signings, the two signatures happening. It's all meant to kind of underscore the tricky logistics.
Uh-huh.
And you guys have both sort of alluded to this episode. I mean, you probably know by now that if you don't basically know the outlines of what happened in this story, you should probably watch the thing first and then come back. So I'm just going to say, and we are kind of spoiling plot here. But the episode in which he kills Dickie When I saw that episode, I thought, this is immediately going to go on a lot of lists of best TV episodes of the streaming era, I think. Because the killing of Dickie, followed by, as Aisha alluded to, the cleaning up, the disposing of the body, the logistics of what you do with the boat, is all extremely drawn out. It is done mostly without dialogue and mostly without other actors. So you get this just sort of intense performance by Andrew Scott. And also, there are these moments, you talked about it being a little bit funny at times. There are these moments of dark humor in that episode that were so surprising to me that I bark laughed when they happened. I was so on board for this whole thing. There are so many decisions I think are so cool. I want to talk a little bit about how differently it sees Dickie and Marge. Because Marge in particular, if I'm remembering the movie correctly, Marge in the movie is a much more friendly person.
At the start, yes.
At least at the beginning. She starts out as really friendly to Tom, whereas Marge here is suspicious of Tom from the outset and kind of becomes more of an obstacle. And Dickie, it's not that Johnny Flynn isn't attractive. He is, but he's not shot as like that almost marble statue way that they treated Jude Law in the film. He's just like some dude. He's just rich. Do you know what I mean?
Exactly. Yes. That's the smart thing they're doing here, right? Because Law was sexy and swaggering and charismatic and warm. He pulled you in, right?
And everybody loved him.
Everyone loved him. Flynn is playing rich, as you say. He's playing privileged. He's playing aloof, which makes you lean in closer, right? Makes you work for it.
Yeah.
And Andrew Scott, who can go big, we've seen him go big. The first thing I saw him in was Sherlock as Moriarty. He can go huge. This is his more measured mode, but that's okay because in black and white, his eyes look black as a shark's eyes.
Absolutely.
It's so crazy.
Absolutely. I think they have to be doing that on purpose. Like his eyes just look like black marbles.
I mean, one of my other favorite aspects of this is sort of the way that Tom plays everyone in the series. And, you know, obviously Marge isn't buying it, but also Freddie isn't buying it. But then, you know, going back to sort of why you need to pay very close attention to the show, or you might miss some things. I love the fact that when Tom is being interviewed by Inspector Ravini, who's played by Maurizio Lombardi, there's a moment where that harkens back to his previous time of interviewing Tom, who was disguised as Dickie, where he gives an anecdote about his wife having been from one place. And later on, when he's interviewing Tom as Tom, but Tom in disguise, he mentions a city and then says that his wife is from a different place.
Did Dickie not tell you I saw him after San Remo? I brought him some of his things from Otrani.
Otrani? My wife is from Otrani.
Is she?
Yes. A beautiful place, but too many stairs.
Yeah, it's like, oh, the inspector also has his own game here, because it's like, your wife can't be from two places.
100%.
I just love those little details.
Yeah.
And the show really gets into, let's say, the less than streamlined workings of the Italian police work at the time. Any scene where a phone rings and it gets answered, then it gets patched through to another office where it rings again, and then somebody, an officer, has to get up and cross the entire room to answer the phone. Now, look, I eat that stuff up, but there are many who won't. You know, things like that, they could feel indulgent, but it just puts you in this world. It puts you in this pace of life.
Yeah. It's interesting you mentioned earlier, Glenn, the queer subtext of this being less sort of overt than the queer subtext of the film. I mean, I read that as in part because I think the film is more showing you an infatuation with Dickie as a person on Tom's part. Whereas this is more Tom being fascinated by Dickie's life and the things that he has and the life that he's living, things he has access to rather than he himself. But I was reading an interview with Andrew Scott, and he was saying he still thinks of Tom as a queer character, but not necessarily having to do with sexuality, more having to do with otherness and outsiderness.
Yeah.
And I thought that was very interesting because I at first was like, okay, so this is like a both a more queer subtext and less queer subtext than the film, because they talk, I feel like they talk about it more in the series. In the sense that Marge is a little bit like challenging Dickie and Tom about like, is he in love with you? Is this thing?
Well, and then Tom and Dickie also then have a conversation explicitly about it.
Dickie, I feel sick about what just happened.
Look, let me just make this really clear. I'm not queer. I think you think I am.
I never thought you were.
Whereas I don't feel like it's as explicitly discussed as often in the movie.
It's more overt, but this is more Highsmith, because Highsmith was writing at a time when she had to code everything and sublimate. And if you go on and read the other novels, like Ripley gets married and seems perfectly happy, and there's always some kind of tension, but it's never – like he lives a very outwardly heterosexual one. So yeah, this is – it just felt like I was reading the novel when I was watching this thing.
Yeah, I just was so completely in the tank for this thing, and it's such a pleasure to me to just kind of sit back and watch something where I'm like, oh, there are going to be 8 episodes of this, and I'm going to like all of it. And that was how I felt from the beginning, and that was exactly what happened. I think everybody's excellent. We have not talked about Elliot Sumner, who plays Freddie, who is a friend of Dickie's who is suspicious of Tom from the beginning.
So good.
They play this character as such a kind of slithery, I don't know, fascinating kind of cipher. You know, the character is that way. The performance is that way. And it kind of makes the collision with Tom more sad almost, because these characters have something in common. They both feel like they are kind of out of sync with the world around them in a way. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And the Freddy character is kind of another side of Marge. It's just like Marge is kind of the, you know, I don't believe you. I don't trust you. She is a 1960s urbane woman. And then you've got Freddy who he kind of, his character just kind of dresses very nicely and suave, whereas she's always kind of in these like very Gwyneth Paltrow-esque or like Goop-esque, where it's like quiet luxury. Like, you know, this is very nice, but like, I'm not showy. Yeah. I love the sort of contrast between those two. Of course, Freddie makes the grave mistake that any character in these things makes, which is he says what he's going to do. He's like, I'm going to bring the cops. And it's like, don't tell him your plan.
There are definitely those moments where it's not exactly suspension of disbelief, but like where, you know, you have that moment where you're like, all right, nobody would do this, right? One of them is the moment that Aisha talked about earlier where Tom is in disguise. And I was like, I'm sorry, that still looks like Tom. But it's okay, because in the world of the show, I think you accept it because they have gone to the trouble of kind of showing you that Tom goes to a lot of trouble and he turns down the lights and everything. So there are always moments in something like this, a kind of a suspense.
It's also the 60s too, right? So it's like the inspector might not know quite what Dickie looks like. So he's not going to necessarily remember or realize that they're the same person. But I do love that sort of cut, because it it takes a second before they cut to Tom in the disguise. And when it finally does, it's just like, I guffawed. I was like, this is hilarious. He's got like facial hair.
So I was puzzled at first by the presence in the series of John Malkovich, who plays a character who is in it for a hot second. He just gets to know Tom a little bit. But then I remembered that in the books, he becomes Tom's associate. And also that John Malkovich played Tom Ripley in a movie called Ripley's Game back in the day, which tells me more is coming.
Yeah.
I really hope more is coming.
Yeah, me too. I'm so here for it. I have been disappointed by so many Netflix series where I feel like they want to make more. Yeah, I will say this is a series that to me fully passes what I have referred to as the chump test, which is like, if you get to the end and you know they want to make more, do you feel like a chump for watching it? Because if there's no more, you're going to be so dissatisfied. This is a complete story. If they never make more, it is an incredibly satisfying set of 8 episodes. But I will be eagerly, eagerly awaiting more of this, because I absolutely loved it. And I am so delighted that we got to talk about it.
Same.
Well, we want to know what you think about Ripley. Find us at facebook.com/PCHH. That brings us to the end of our show. Aisha Harris, Glenn Weldon, thank you so much. I'm so glad that you liked it as much as I did.
Thank you.
Thank you, Linda.
We want to take a moment to thank our Pop Culture Happy Hour Plus subscribers. We appreciate you so much for showing your support of NPR. If you haven't signed up yet, you want to show your support, and you'd like to listen to this show without any sponsor breaks, head over to plus.npr.org/happyhour or visit the link in our show notes. This episode is produced by Hafsa Fathima and Liz Metzger and edited by Jessica Reedy. and Hello Come In provides our theme music. Thank you for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR. I'm Linda Holmes. I really am. I am not pretending to be someone else. And we will see you all tomorrow.